had become so quiet that you can suddenly hear the doves.
Should he give these people a try? Something felt right. He didn't know why.
Welcome to The Appleseed, the storytelling podcast from BYU Radio, where your family can gather for great stories from great storytellers in every episode. Stories bring us together, and we hope the stories on the show will spark memories and thoughts that you can share with the people you love. I'm your host, Sam Payne. You know, sometimes we insist on seeing things in a particular way. We hold to a particular opinion or worldview or belief. And then someone comes along whose influence changes us, changes the way we see things. Sometimes it's a big, sudden change. But more often, the change happens over time. We get wiser or more perceptive or more sensitive over time with the help of the people who are patient with us. Storyteller Noah Baum, who grew up as a secular Jew in Israel, begins our first story by stating clearly and adamantly a strong personal stance. In this case, it's that she doesn't pray. But as the story unfolds, a story about the influence on Noah of her Israeli grandmother, you see a kind of change in Noah. You'll love meeting Noah's grandmother, Savta Mina, in this story called The Hour of the Doves. We should tell you that while this story is uplifting, it's full of hope and family love, it does dwell for a moment on a family member who has taken their own life. If that's a difficult topic for you, we wanted you to know that going in. Here's The Hour of the Doves by Noah Baum.
I do not pray. Growing up in Jerusalem and Israel, praying was never part of my upbringing. Yes, occasionally we lit the Sabbath candle. My father would say the blessing on the bread and the wine. On Passover, there's all sorts of blessings as part of the ritual meal, but that's tradition. I never paid attention to the words. The words had no meaning. I don't pray. I'm an Israeli, a secular Jew. Praying is for old people, religious people, old people that go to synagogue and mutter prayers from ancient books. But my Savta Mina, my grandmother Mina, was religious. And all my childhood I spent with my Savta Mina, from the age of 3 through 17, every holiday, every summer vacation. She had a small one-bedroom flat in Tel Aviv, where above the piano in the small bedroom, there was the picture of Yaakov, a young man with a hat of a religious man. Yaakov was her son, my mother's brother. He was killed in the 1948 war for our independence when he was 22 years old. When her brother was killed, my mother stopped being religious. But my Savta never talks about her son, Yaakov. And in the living room, there is a framed embroidery of a meadow with little specks of red flowers. Yudit embroidered that. Yudit was her daughter, my mother's sister. She died when she was 23 years old. My Savta never talks about her daughter, Yudit. And we were always told that Yudit died of a lung disease. But it was many decades later, when I was in my late 40s, that I discovered that Yudit, who was 15 when her brother was killed, never recovered from his death. And after 8 years of struggle with depression, at the age of 23, took her own life. Is that why there's no pictures of Yudit on the wall? The taboo of suicide. My Savta never talks about those she lost. My Savta never cries. My Savta is always full of life and energy. Gegangen, let's go. When I'm with my Savta, we are on the go. We go to the beach every day. We go to visit the cousins. We go to the market and she buys me everything. Oh, freshly squeezed carrot juice from street vendors, patent leather shoes, puffed pastry, dresses, ribbons from my hair. And my Savta loves to joke with me. She grabs my butt and says, in her strange mixture of Hebrew and Yiddish, "Is this a große Tuchus? Is this a big butt?" And I say, "No, you have a große Tuchus." "Oh, nein, nein, nein. Safta has. A sehr, sehr große Tuchus. Safta has a very huge butt." When I'm with my Safta, we laugh, we do things. And because she is religious, every Friday evening, she lights the Sabbath candles. And when I was a little girl, that was a magic time that I loved. I loved especially the time on Friday afternoon before the sun sets. In my 8-year-old mind, it is the hour of the doves. It's that time every Friday afternoon when all the buses stop running all at once. And suddenly, the engine rumblings, all the screeching brakes, everything disappears. And a quiet descends on the city, a stillness like no other. Even conversations become quiet and no one yells. It becomes so quiet that you can suddenly hear the doves. They're always there, invisible in the eaves beneath the roof. And I love to sit in the enclosed balcony on the folding aluminum lounge chair and listen. Embraced by their coos and gurgles, the mysterious wonder of their conversations, I'm cradled in peace. That is the hour of the doves. But then the light begins to change. The sun is setting. And from the kitchen, I hear my Safta preparing the candles in the 3-branched silver candelabra on the table. And I come to watch. "Safta, why are there 3 candles?" She shrugs. "Zu gedanken, to remember." And I watch as she covers her head with a sheer white scarf. And she lights those candles. And then she circles her hands like an ancient sorceress, invoking the light to dispel the darkness. And then she covers her face and she mutters the prayers. And she pronounces the words the way the old people do from the old country, with the S instead of the T, and we don't speak Hebrew like that at all. And then her lips continue to move. But I can hardly make out the words, and suddenly it's not my Safta anymore. And it's a little scary. She's somewhere far away, muttering on and on, whispering names, long list of strange names. Ashik, Uja, Idele. Hypnotized, I watch a trickle of tears trickle through her fingers along the grooves of her wrinkled hand, and my throat tightens. I want to reach out and pull those hands away from her face, get my smiling, loving Safta back. But she's so far out of my reach, I dare not get close. Like something holy I know I'm not allowed to touch, I just stand there and watch. And finally, the list ends, always with the same 2 names. Meine Yaakov Ale, my Yaakov. Meine Juditl, my Judit. And then the hands come off her face. She wipes the tears and smiles. A guten Shabbos, a good Sabbath. Soll sein Shulam, let there be peace. Umein, 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 amen. And she pulls me close into her smothering embrace that smells like 4 7-Eleven cologne and fried onions and cheap lipstick. And she covers my head and face with kisses. Her arms are the comfort and safety of this world. For years, I witnessed this sacred ritual again and again. In my teenage years, I began to understand that those names she whispers are of all those she lost. her father and mother, brothers and sisters, their husbands and wives and children, the cousins, the aunts, the uncles, all taken from her by the Nazis. In my 20s, I still came over to my Safta Mina almost every Friday afternoon, but I did not stay until the hour of the doves. Who has time? I was busy, gegangen, on the go. Friday afternoon, I sit in the cafe with my friends, a sacred Friday afternoon ritual in Tel Aviv. Who has time for all this old world stuff, lighting candles, and who needs all that remembering anyway? The year I got married, my Safta turned 89 and started to forget. And a year later, when I left for America with my American husband, she no longer recognized me. 8 months later, when I was already pregnant with my first child, my Safta Mina died alone in a nursing home. And I was angry. I was so angry that she died. I was so angry that she died alone, so far from me, not herself. Why? Why does it have to happen like this? Why did she have to lose her mind like that? I didn't want to think about my broken heart. I did not cry. There's an old story from Syria about a drought. They say it was a terrible, terrible drought, and the people prayed and fasted, but the rains didn't come. And one night the rabbi, he hears a voice in his dream, and the voice said, God will send rain only if Rachamim Chayat will pray for the people. And the rabbi wakes up confused. Rachamim Chayat, that's the silent man who sits at the back of the synagogue. He doesn't know how to read. How can he lead the people in prayer? But what other choice does he have? Once again, he gathers the congregation to pray for rain. And everyone gathers around the bima, that's the elevated space in the middle of the synagogue, right in front of Aron HaKodesh, that's the holy ark, the cabinet that holds the sacred scriptures, the Torah scrolls. And everybody is waiting for the rabbi to step up on the bima and lead them in prayer. But instead, the rabbi stands and calls out, Yalev, Yavo, come forth and pray in the name of the people, Achamim, the son of David. Achamim in the back of the synagogue looks up. His name. To come before Aron HaKodesh, the Holy Ark. Trembling, he whispers in the rabbi's ear, Abi, you know I cannot read. Please, do not shame me. But the rabbi says, today, Achamim, you are Shliach Tzibur. You are the representative of the congregation. It is you who must pray for us. Mortified, Achamim looks around and then he asks permission to bring something he needs to be able to pray. And soon he's back in the synagogue with a little clay jar that has two spouts in it. Still trembling, he steps up on the bima to face the congregation. I ask that you all pray with all your heart. And then he turns to face Aron HaKodesh, the Holy Ark, and the congregation, as is the custom, rises. And everyone chants the appropriate words for this moment when the Holy Ark is opened and the Torah scrolls, the sacred scriptures, are revealed. And now it is the time for the leader to lead them in prayer. But Rachamim is not holding a prayer book. He's holding a clay jar. And he lifts it up. Ribono shel Olam, Master of the Universe, I don't know how to read. I'm a poor man. It is hard. Sometimes my children are hungry, and when they're hungry, they cry. And when they cry, my heart breaks, and I cry too. I collect my tears in this jar. It is all I have. I ask my wife to be buried with this jar, but I offer it now to you, Ribono shel Olam. If this jar of tears is not enough, I'm willing to break it here before the people. And at that moment, there was a flash of lightning and a crash of thunder, and rain began to fall. I did not cry. I did not cry for many, many years for my Safta Mina, who is gone. But one day, it was the Friday afternoon, But I was far, far from the hour of the doves. I was already living here in America. My daughter just turned 4, my son was 2. And it was quiet. The sun was just beginning to set, and suddenly I heard the cooing of a dove. And I found myself putting 2 candles in the candlesticks I got in a garage sale the other day and lighting them. And I circled my hands like she did. And I covered my face. And suddenly I was there, standing at the kitchen table, watching my Saftamina bring in the light to dispel the darkness. And the tears trickled through my fingers. I had no idea what the words of the prayer were, so I made up my own. Bucha Shechina b'libeinu, Bucha Shabbat b'veiteinu, Shabbat Shalom. Blessed is the female presence of the divine in our heart. Blessed is the Sabbath in our home. May it be a Sabbath of peace. And I kissed my children. And you know, I've been doing it ever since. Today I know the words of the prayer, I chant them, but I always add the ones I made up. And I feel close to my Saftamina when I pray. And sometimes I offer my tears.
That was Noah Baum with The Hour of the Doves. In listening to this story about how a person living thoughtfully and authentically can influence another person, it reminds me of my brother, Joshua. Joshua is kind of a remarkable musician, a guitar player and a banjo player. And when he was a young man in his 20s, he decided he wanted to leave his little Utah home for the adventure of living in New York City and making a living as a busker playing guitar and banjo in the subway. It was an incredible adventure, and he did pretty well. Pulled down enough money to feed himself and house himself all the time he was there. And during part of the time that he was in New York, he lived in a neighborhood where there was a very high concentration of Hasidic Jews, lots of clear, visible indicators all around him of the faith and cultural traditions of those folks. The clothing and ritual and prayer and religious artifacts of that community were all around him all the time. Now, my brother was not a Jew. He had grown up as a Latter-day Saint in our little hometown in Utah. And to tell the truth, he had become a little bit distant from the faith of his childhood. But in New York, seeing the fervor of that Jewish community in which he lived, the richness that he saw in their practices and observances, that awakened something in Joshua. He became interested in a new way in his own faith tradition. He saw his own faith through new eyes. He became more serious about his own spirituality. And much of that has stayed with him. I admire the thoughtful outlook my brother has on things of the spirit. And I'm thankful for the community that surrounded him in New York all those years ago, how it influenced him and deepened him. Thinking about the influence people can have on other people just by living authentically, with deliberate attention to the things they say they believe. How watching people live thoughtfully and purposefully, whatever their traditions, can help us be thoughtful and deliberate about our own. And that's where Noah's story took me. Where did it take you? And who will you take along? Our next story is a historical tale from storyteller Pippa White. Pippa often takes amazing, true historical stories and tells them in the character of the people who lived them, and often in rhyme. An evening of stories with Pippa often incorporates a hat rack stocked with hats that represent the characters in one story or another. She'll don a hat, and the story comes alive. This story is about how a reluctant young boy finds his heart changing while on a journey to find a new family. Here's Pippa White with Lee Nayling's Orphan Train story on the Appleseed.
Right now, I have an orphan train story for you. Are you all familiar with the orphan trains? Yes? Most everybody? Good. A little bit. Okay. Not everybody. No, that's okay. That's okay. It's a kind of a forgotten piece of American history. In the mid-1800s, there were thousands, literally, some say as many as 30,000 homeless children living on the streets of New York City. Isn't that astonishing? It was due to a lot of things, mostly poverty, of course. Also, immigrants having a very hard time. And also, many times, they were real orphans. These were children who had lost both parents. The problem became so great that a wonderful man named Charles Loring Brace opened an orphanage. There were only a handful of orphanages in the whole state of New York. But as soon as he opened the orphanage, it was full. And another orphanage, it was full. Another orphanage. So they realized they couldn't solve the problem with orphanages. So they got this great idea. Let's put these children on trains and send them out to new homes in the rest of the country, mostly the Midwest, also upstate New York. They felt that farms would have lots of food for these children and lots of room for them. And so this was really the beginning of foster care in our country. These trains ran for 75 years. Thousands of children, they think at least 250,000, maybe more, rode these trains to new lives. And sometimes they got great lives, and sometimes they got so-so lives. And sadly, there were a few who didn't do too well, but not too many. So what I have for you now is an orphan train story. This is Lee Nayling's story. Lee, his story was written up in a book called Orphan Train Rider, One Boy's True Story, written by Andrea Warren and published by Houghton Mifflin. And I'm grateful to both the author and the publisher for letting me tell a much truncated version of that story. Lee's story is quite unusual. There's some rough edges to this story, I will warn you, but I think it's a story of transformation. And I like stories of transformation. One thing I need to tell you before I begin, Lee had a brother named Leo, and Leo figures in the story, so don't get confused. We've got Lee and Leo. So I'm going to tell you a story, typical and true, kind of things these kids went through. This is a story of a boy named Lee from upstate New York, about 1923. He was 6 years old then, one of seven. Mama died in childbirth, went to heaven. Papa couldn't cope one thing and another. I can't farm all day and then be a mother. So to the oldest three, he just said, go. You're on your own. You can get a job, you know. The infant and the two-year-old he took to a friend, but Lee and brother Leo to the orphanage did send. Lee said he belonged to a family one day, the next to an institution, cold and gray, with stern, unfriendly adults. Strict was the norm, not enough food, and seldom warm. 2 years of that with public school, where he was teased and taunted, orphan fool, a life so lonely, bleak, and sad. Lee developed a temper, short and bad. 2 years of that. Then, lo and behold, you're going on a train, these kids were told. You're going on a train to a new mom and dad. You're getting a family. Aren't you glad? Well, no, thought Lee. I've got a dad. My own family home is what I want so bad. But what could he do at age 8 or 9? Nothing to do but toe the line. Strange thing happened, though, when he was boarding that train. Whom should he meet but his dad again, with the baby brother, now 4 years old, and a pink envelope, or so I'm told. This here's your brother, Gerald's his name. Look after Leo and Gerald the same. In this envelope is my address. Write to me when you all get out west. So Lee was ecstatic, said nothing's wrong. My dad'll come and get us before ere long. Said to the chaperone, see this envelope here? It's from my father, he said with a tear. So he slept that night to the clickety-clack, not a worry or a care. He'd soon be back with his brothers and older sis, back with his father. He was sure of this. But in the morning, the envelope wasn't there. He searched in his pockets, under the seat, everywhere. And the chaperone said, "You must forget your past." And 9-year-old Lee was simply aghast. Lee could just feel his temperature rise, anger and bitterness at adults' lies. She had taken that envelope, that much he knew. And there wasn't a thing a little kid could do. The train traveled for miles, made several stops where some lucky kids got moms and pops. Then they landed in Texas, tired and beat, were marched to a church on aching feet. And people came and people chose. "I'll take this girl, I'll call her Rose. Maybe I'll take two, a he and a she." "Oh no," thought Lee, "will anyone want three?" And then a couple chose Gerald, and he fell in their arms. But when they got to the door, he turned in alarm. "I want my brothers," he cried. You could hear the fear. Nothing to do but hold back the tear. And then a couple chose Leo. Lee thought he would die. "Take my brother too," pleaded Leo with a cry. And the man and his wife, they exchanged a long glance. "Yes," they said, "we'll take that chance." So I'm going to warn you right now, though things seem pretty fine, Leo was happy, but Lee still pined. For the envelope, a future with his dad, Leo was okay, but Lee pretty bad. So he sulked and he moped and he would kind of brood. He wasn't polite. He was downright rude. But what could he do, and where did he belong, and why did everything always seem so wrong? The chaperone came and took Lee away. "They can only handle one, so Leo will stay. I've got another family that's going to take you. Cheer up, Lee, don't look so blue." Lee didn't even get a chance to say goodbye to Leo, his brother. I don't know why. Placed with another family, he made a childish mistake, got moved again like so much freight. Now, if you're beginning to think, "I've had enough of a story about a kid who had it so rough," bear with me, folks. It gets better, I swear. Lee had a journey to take, and he's almost there. Almost. By now, he was miserable. Things couldn't be worse. He hated everyone. His life was cursed. He was a nobody, a fool, a loser, a cad. He hated everyone. Life was just plain bad. Placed with another couple, he was quiet and glum. All adults were heartless, mean, and dumb. He'd run away at dawn's first light. No, he'd run away in the middle of the night. The woman took him upstairs, said, "This is your room. Look out the window. You can see the moon. Now I'll tuck you in and you sleep tight." Then she kissed him on the cheek and said, "Good night." A kiss. Had anyone ever kissed Lee? A kiss. Who'd want to kiss me? Tears came to his eyes. They started to flow. He cried half the night, but Lee didn't go. Next morning, though, he was angry again. He'd run away the next night. They were not his kin. He'd run to his father. He'd run anywhere. No one ever had or ever would care. But breakfast smelled good, and he was a hungry child. And when he reached for a biscuit, in a voice so mild, the woman said, "We say grace first here. Close your eyes and fold your hands, my dear." Well, Lee was hungry, so he did obey. But what did he hear? What did they say? "Thank you, Lord, for we feel such joy that you have brought us this special boy." And the prayer went on. It didn't end there. "Thank you, God, that he's in our care. What a privilege to have a child to raise, a child to brighten all our days." He couldn't believe it. "They're thankful for me, thankful for sullen, angry Lee, thankful to have him in their home, thankful to call him all their own." After breakfast, to town, to go to the store, new shoes, new clothes, a haircut, and more. Now there's the school, and there's the square, and there's the park, right over there. Now, we know you've got two brothers here, too. You'll see them often, we promise you. Now, we want you to meet a neighbor, a friend. Next stop is right around this bend. Lee was stunned, didn't know what to feel. Were they sincere, honest, real? Should he give these people a try? Something felt right. He didn't know why. I can see my brothers. That's what they'd said. And they said they had a pet for him, a dog named Red. A house, a home, parents, a pet. Maybe he wouldn't run just yet. Lee thought of the orphanage, New York, his past. And now here he was in Texas, Texas, so vast. All his family in New York were working on their own. Who was more likely to give Lee a real home? He looked in their faces, from him to her. If he ran, it would hurt them, that's for sure. He thought of the kiss, the promise, the prayer. And for the first time in his life, Lee realized maybe grown-ups can care. They took his hands, and he walked between on what was becoming the most beautiful day he had ever seen. Because to every person they met, they said to everyone, "We'd like you to meet Lee, Lee, our son."
That was Pippa White with Lee Nayling's Orphan Train story. Who in your life has inspired a change of heart in you? Do you like to remember those who have cared for you? Have you ever experienced a hardship that increased your capacity for love? I bet you've got some stories. We hope you'll share them with the people you love. In fact, we hope you'll share the stories with us. We might share them on the show. You can tag us on social media or send us a message at theappleseed@byu.edu. That's theappleseed, all one word, at byu.edu. We want to thank Noah Baum and Pippa White for sharing their stories with us today. You've listened to their tales. Now it's time to share some of your own. Are you interested in discovering how God works not only in your life, but around the world? Give a listen to In Good Faith, a BYU radio podcast that explores all kinds of faith traditions, wherever you get your podcasts.